Our author tells of a British fascination with defeat, and one realizes that history will repeat, here we go again, such a situation. The British face to face with Europe, not the current Brexit marathon race, but Arnhem, the battle for the bridges we fought in 1944 and lost, but a chapter in the war that still resounds in retrospect, and therefore, no, I must respect our author, as you all heave a sigh of relief. As I introduce our author, Anthony Beaver.
Barry, thank you so much for your deathless poetry. I'm deeply touched. It started off, the whole story, as one of victory euphoria. You've got to remember, here we are, the end of August, beginning of September, the British armies, the American armies, surging forward from the line of the River Seine towards Germany, towards Belgium. And the trouble was, actually, that both the British and the Americans had completely misread the 20th of July plot against Hitler. They assumed that any army which was trying to blow up their own commander-in-chief must be in a state of disintegration. Well, unfortunately, they were completely wrong. And in fact, while the planning of Operation Market Garden, as it became known, the drop of 3.5 parachute divisions from the Belgian frontier into Holland and then northwards towards Arnhem to jump the Rhine at Arnhem, all of this was prepared on the basis of that idea that the Germans were in a state of collapse. Now, General Sosabowski, the commander of the Polish Independent Parachute Brigade, warned the British time and again at every briefing. He would say, but the Germans, General, the Germans. Now, Sosabowski knew perfectly well that the Germans reacted very quickly indeed and punished any mistake very brutally. And in fact, the trouble was that, of course, the Germans had a ruthless sense of prioritization and moved very quickly, neither of which were British virtues, I'm afraid. Anyway, here we have the early days of September. Montgomery has this idea that he wants to jump the Rhine at Arnhem to get ahead of the Americans so that Eisenhower will basically hand him all of the all of the supplies, but also command over American formations. Because Montgomery was deeply offended the fact that he was no longer going to be the ground forces commander in Europe, now that Eisenhower, from the 1st of September, was the supreme Allied commander and actually based in Europe. And, sorry, just checking so that I don't go on too long. Anyway, Eisenhower, following the American practice, basically gave Monty his head. The British tended to be much more controlling in top-down chain of command. So he gave Monty his head. He allowed him to have the first Allied Airborne Army, as it was called, which was consisted both of the British and the American parachute divisions. And Monty had this plan, and he went to see Eisenhower on the 10th of September in Brussels in the aeroplane, and he didn't even tell Eisenhower really what the plan was. He summoned General Boy Browning, the husband of Daphne du Maurier, over from England, and he was told to sort out the plan with all of the various details provided by Montgomery, with General Dempsey, the commander of the 2nd British Army. And was to fly back to England and basically tell the Americans of the Allied Airborne Army what the master's plan was. Now, Montgomery had been told, both by Eisenhower and by the British Chiefs of Staff, that because it was an airborne operation, the air side, the RAF and the US Air Force in this particular case, had the final say. But Monty refused to consult them at all. He was convinced that the RAF were, especially Air Chief Marshal Lee Mallory, who was, he thought, a gutless bugger, to quote Monty, because he was so afraid about the airdrops on Normandy and that they would all go wrong. And so Monty would not discuss it with them at all. He would impose his plan. So that evening of the 10th of September, Browning tells them what the Field Marshal's plan is. And then the Brigadier General Williams, the head of Troop Carrier Command, says, well, hang on a second, you haven't taken this into account, you haven't taken that into account, i.e. the distances are greater than you thought, therefore we can only have one glider behind each aeroplane, we can't have two gliders. The days are shorter, so we can only have one lift in the whole day. And all of this threw all of Montgomery's plans and Browning's plans basically aside. But Browning was so desperate to command the operation that he did not, as he should have done, go straight back to Brussels and say, sorry, Field Marshal, we must rethink the whole thing. Browning insisted on going ahead because he knew that if he didn't command it, it would be handed over to General Ridgway, who actually had much more airborne experience than he did. So as a result, the whole planning was wrong right from the start and right from the top. The other problem, of course, was that with only one lift, i.e. one lot of aircraft going out in the whole day on the first day, it meant that half of the troops had to be left behind to guard the landing zones and the drop zones for the next lot to come in. So basically, that meant that they achieved no surprise at all. And especially in the case of the British Airborne dropping to the west of Arnhem, they had 8 miles to get to their major objective and had to cross a city of 100,000 people. So from that point of view, I'm afraid it really was doomed. Sosabowski, as I said, pointed out the problems. Others felt, well, actually, some of the other plans they've come up with beforehand were even crazier than this. So at least this one, we've got 3.5 divisions, so we stand a chance. Anyway, to cut a very long story short, the heroism of the troops, and above all, the heroism also of the Dutch people, who took tremendous risks, pulling the wounded off the streets under fire, caring for them in their own homes. Many of them were executed by the Germans for helping the enemy during this particular battle. The Dutch railway men had also brought in a strike and prevented German reinforcements and supplies arriving. So the Dutch had really put themselves in harm's way. The battle stood no chance as far as the British were concerned. They were too far away. There was no way that the Guards Armored Division could get to them in time. And the rest of 30 Corps, commanded by General Sir Brown Horrocks. And basically, they were ground down and surrounded. What they had underestimated was the way that people talk about, oh, they dropped on two SS Panzer divisions. Well, actually, those Panzer divisions only had 3 serviceable tanks. What happened was that the Germans brought in the tanks by that very night of the 18th of September. They had these Blitz transports coming from all over Germany bringing Tiger tanks. So these lightly armed paratroopers running out of ammunition, running out of supplies, because it was another disaster, that they didn't have the right frequencies to contact the Air Force. And as a result, they were dropping the supplies in the wrong places. This was incredible bravery on the part of the pilots, there's no doubt about that. And many of them went in time and time again. But it was only later that they found that they had the wrong frequencies and none of the radios were working properly. Let's face it, it was the most phenomenal cock-up of probably almost one of the most greatest of the Second World War in that particular way. The tragedy was, of course, afterwards that people had to, should we say, cover up or avoid responsibility. I'm afraid the British establishment has always been rather good at trying to cover up its own particular faults in that way. General Browning was sent off as Chief of Staff to Mountbatten in Southeast Asia, so sort of he was out of the way. And it was rather tragic. In fact, General Urquhart, who commanded the British Airborne Division at Arnhem, was made to take quite a lot of the blame, but quite unfairly, I think. Actually, one of his daughters told me that she knew Browning's daughter very well, and that actually Browning himself had died basically of drink and had never mentioned Arnhem again for the rest of his life. But I think the real person responsible was actually Field Marshal Montgomery, who claimed afterwards that somehow that it had all been a great success. The fact that they got 90% of the way to Arnhem implied a 90% success. But as our Chief Marshal Tedder pointed out, he said one can jump off a cliff with even more chance of survival, except for the last few inches. and also Prince Bernhard, the Commander-in-Chief of the Dutch forces, pointed out that his country could not afford another Montgomery success. And that, I think, was certainly true, because the suffering of the Dutch afterwards was simply appalling, and I'll come back to that in a second. But I think one of the most shameful aspects of the Arnhem operation was the way that they tried to put the blame. This is partly Horrocks, who was basically not fit, either physically or psychologically, from the wounds that the desperate wounds he'd received in Italy. But above all, I'm afraid, Montgomery, but also Browning, in the way that Sosabowski and the Poles were criticized, and almost it was implied that they were not ready, or they were not determined to fight. This is totally untrue. Sosabowski and his men were incredibly brave and were determined to kill as many Germans as they possibly could. In fact, they were deeply irritated at times by sort of the British way that they had to treat everything as a joke. The Poles, as I say, were deadly serious. They saw not just their own country destroyed, but almost their own identity as a nation at risk, and they fought like anything. But Sosabowski was blamed. Sosabowski was even accused almost of cowardice by Montgomery, and I think that that is actually one of the most outrageous slanders, in fact, of the Second World War, and is still a very, very bitter issue in Poland today, as I know only too well from visits to Warsaw. But as I say, the real suffering was the Dutch population afterwards, because the Germans, deliberately to punish the Dutch for their support to the British and the Americans during the operation, then cut off all supplies, and the cities of the major cities of Rotterdam, Amsterdam, and The Hague, especially, had no food, and the hunger winter of 1944 to 1945 killed over 20,000. I came across secret tapings in the British archives, in the National Archives at Kew, where they had found the conversations of German officers in the prison camps, which were, as I say, secretly taped and listened to by Jewish Germans working for the British, where soldiers, apparently in German soldiers, had been boasting that now they didn't, in Holland, that they hadn't even bothered to pay at a brothel, because for half a loaf of bread they could get any Dutch woman to do what they wanted. I mean, the brutality, the sheer exploitation of the Dutch population at the time was beyond shocking. So the Dutch had many reasons, if you like, not to be grateful to the British for that sort of liberation in that particular way, but the generosity, and above all, the way that the population of Arnhem and Oosterbeek and the surrounding area welcome the veterans at on the anniversary, and this year, of course, is the 75th anniversary, with triumphal arches, with the Pegasus flag and symbol of the airborne hanging from all the houses, and also that tradition of the school children placing flowers on every single one of the graves of those who died there. It's, I think, one of the most moving legacies of the Second World War, that forgiveness and that generosity by the Dutch towards the British. And also, still to this day, a resentment against what happened and what was done to them by the Germans. It was not one of the finest moments, except, of course, the bravery of the soldiers and officers who were there, who I'm afraid were sent into a totally disastrous situation, which was not of their making at all. So, in some ways, if you like, it's a sad book from the point of view of the truth of what happened there. And I'm afraid that the British, as I heard, you know, as you heard, the British have tended to make almost a fetiche of heroic failure. And Arnhem was a heroic failure, but it was certainly heroic, there's no doubt about that. And just simply to read what people did, the self-sacrifice and the generosity, both of the civilians and of the soldiers amongst themselves, is, I think, in itself extremely moving. Thank you very much indeed.